Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. Many of us will ring in the new year by eating out at some point over the next few days. The National Restaurant Association has issued its culinary forecast for 2016, and it includes more locally sourced meats and seafood and less kale salad and gluten-free food. To get a sense of whether Phoenix chefs are following or leading some of these trends, I'm joined by Cal Faber, a freelance food writer for Phoenix New Times, who's looked at this very issue. And Cal, what are some of the big trends to look out for nationally?
Some of the biggies, it was really interesting this year because a lot of the trends were dominated by culinary themes, which were hyper-local sourcing of meat and produce, natural and minimally processed ingredients, and a lot about environmental and sustainability practices. So we weren't seeing a lot of food and ingredients in those top 20 hot trends. But we were seeing ethnic condiments and spices, which I take to mean sriracha mainly, some harissa, and ethnic breakfast items as well.
How has Phoenix been doing in living up to some of these trends?
I think we're actually doing pretty well. I think we get a lot of flack for not being San Francisco or New York, who are honestly oversaturated with really, really competitive restaurants. But we have some really great things here. As far as local meat and produce sourcing, we've got some really, really great ranchers and farmers. And as far as produce, we have no shortage of local farms. We have almost 40 farmers markets in town now.
Do you get the sense that Phoenix chefs are following these trends, or they're just sort of doing these things anyway because they want to or they think it's the right thing to do or whatever, and it just so happens that these are things that chefs in other parts of the country are also doing?
I think our chefs are really creative people. I think a lot of them have worked in other cities and that they work really hard to keep their product fresh and exciting for consumers. So I don't get the sense that it's a follow the leader type of situation. The National Restaurant Association's poll is really from chefs all around the country, so we're a part of that as well.
You reference Phoenix in the past has sort of had this reputation as not being sort of a food city and a foodie city, and has sort of been a late adopter of some trends. Do you think that's starting to change?
I really, really do. I think it's sometimes hard to see because it's a very small concentration of restaurants who are bringing this out. But we've got some really, really great places, and I would love to see that expand into even more places.
Is it in some ways, do you think, easier to adopt some of these national trends when you don't have a gazillion restaurants that are all trying to do basically the same thing?
I do and I don't. I think that a little bit of competition is healthy, and I think that kind of drives the creativity. The more people we have doing it, the richer the scene is going to get. But I don't think that we have a shortage of creativity right now.
As Phoenix continues to add restaurants and add, some innovative restaurants and innovative concepts, do you think that it will become harder to follow some of these trends, or do you think maybe Phoenix will start to create or start some of these trends that other places will pick up on?
I think Phoenix is a pretty stubborn city, and we want what we want. Diners want what they want to eat, and chefs are going to have to respond to that. But like I said, I think the more that we bring in and the more restaurants we can keep developing and keep supporting, it's only going to breed more creativity.
And it seems like some of these trends that the National Restaurant Association has identified kind of play into strengths that the Phoenix area and the Valley and the state really in general have. You referenced lots of fresh, locally sourced produce and meats and things like that. Those are things that are already happening here.
Absolutely. And I think one of the most surprising top trends, a surging trend this year that we surprisingly do quite well at is actually African flavors. So, we're really not that far behind, and we've got some really surprising ways we're making it exciting.
As Phoenix sort of moves its way up on the food scene, is it almost kind of inevitable that we will start to follow some of these trends just by virtue of having greater volume and greater diversity?
Absolutely. I do agree with that. The more I think other potential entrepreneurs and restaurateurs can see the success of all of these really dynamic places, they're going to say, oh, I can do that too. And they're going to come along and hopefully try to add and build onto the community.
Cal Faber is a freelance food writer for Phoenix New Times. Cal, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ with help from our friends at The World and The Takeaway. And with Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. We often hear that we're a sleep-deprived nation, but a sleep specialist from the University of Arizona says we may be even more dream-deprived than sleep-deprived. KJZZ's Phil Latzman spoke to Dr. Ruben Naaman about the important role dreams play in a good night's sleep.
This may sound abstract when we say we all need to dream, but we literally need physiologically to dream.
We do, physiologically and psychologically. There are many good things that happen during dreaming. For one, we experience learning and memory formation when we dream. And if we don't, it compromises our memory. People who don't dream, in fact, I should say dream loss is associated with increases in dementia, cognitive problems, Alzheimer's disease. So it compromises our cognitive functioning. The other thing that dreaming does, which is really critical, is it regulates emotion. Dream loss is significantly linked to clinical depression.
What are the dreams that matter? We hear a lot about REM sleep, rapid eye movement. If you're dreaming in REM sleep, is that a quality dream? And what are the dreams that are good dreams?
Well, I would say that we dream all the time. Now, this can sound strange to people, but I look at REM sleep as a window that appears rhythmically, mostly in the latter part of the night, through which we can most clearly see the dream. But we dream all the time. Dreaming is the context of waking. It's really the larger picture, the framework of waking. So, you know, the question of, you know, what are good dreams or bad dreams? There's good quality dreaming when we sleep well, just as there's good quality food we can eat. When we sleep well, we will dream well. A lot of people have either limited dreams or very superficial, what we call low-flying dreams that are repetitive and monotonous. We want deeper and richer dreams.
Some of the dreams that I think we all can remember are the bad dreams, the nightmares. Mm-hmm. How significant are the dreams that we can actually remember? And is it so that we tend to remember bad dreams more than good dreams?
We not only tend to remember bad dreams. Generally speaking, most dreaming is what we would call bad. Now, let me clarify that. I would say, first of all, that even though there are lots of bad dreams, dreaming per se is a good thing. When we dream, we're actually digesting, we're psychologically digesting all the experiences we've consumed during the day. And in the same way that digestion of food is not a pretty process, if you were to open the bowel, it wouldn't look very pretty. As we're digesting information, we're breaking it down, the mind is sifting through what it wants to keep and what it wants to excrete. It's not necessarily a pretty process, but it's an essential process.
So for those listening right now thinking, I don't dream enough, I can't remember my dreams, I have too many bad dreams, what's your best advice for them?
Well, first of all, to dream well, which is important, we need to sleep well. We need to do anything and everything we can to improve our sleep. And I think there's a lot of information available to people about that all over the web, in the media. I think we also need to open our minds and open our hearts to dreaming. We need to reconsider, as is the case in virtually all other indigenous cultures in the world, that dreaming is a critical part of life. And that receptivity often allows us to begin to remember our dreams.
Dr. Ruben Naaman is sleep specialist, clinical assistant professor of medicine at the University of Arizona. Dr. Naaman, thanks very much for being here.
My pleasure.
That's KJZZ's Phil Latzman. And with help from our partners at The World, you're listening to the show on KJZZ.
And you're listening to the show on this New Year's Eve day.
All Things Considered goes where you are and takes you places you never thought to go.
Right now, the wildfire threat in the Pacific Northwest is
this month marks 10 years since Katrina bore
Michael
down.
Brown in Ferguson, Eric Garner in New York, Tamir Rice in Cleveland.
The town of Guadalupe contracts with the sheriff's office for police services, but there's a tense history between the agency and the town residents.
There's more to every story. Listen this afternoon.
Stay informed this afternoon with All Things Considered from 3 to 6. Checking traffic, up north, watch for crashes on the 101 northbound at Thunderbird and also on the 17 northbound at Greenway. On the 202 west at 24th Street, the shoulder is blocked. And farther east, look for crashes on the 101 southbound at the 60 exit ramp and also on the 60 east at Val Vista. It's mostly cloudy and 58 degrees at 231.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. A man in Rochester, New York, is accused of planning to carry out a New Year's Eve attack in that city. From member station WXXI, Randy Gorman reports the U.S. citizen is now under arrest.
Federal authorities accused 25-year-old Emmanuel Lutchman of trying to provide support to terrorists and help ISIS kill innocent civilians on New Year's Eve at a restaurant bar in the Rochester area. Luchman claimed to be getting directions from an overseas ISIS member as part of his interest in eventually joining the terrorist group. Luchman is described as a convert to Islam, who, according to court papers, told an FBI informant that he hates the U.S. and wants to live under the caliphate. Officials say Luchman went with the informant to a Walmart to buy knives, a machete, ski masks, and plastic cable ties. They say at one point he also talked about using a pressure cooker bomb. Luchman has a criminal history dating back about a decade, which includes a conviction for robbery. For NPR News, I'm Randy Gortman in Rochester.
Parts of the Midwest are continuing to deal with record flooding after days of torrential rains. In Missouri, swollen rivers and streams in the St. Louis area are at unprecedented levels. In St. Louis County, the town of Eureka is underwater.
Many of the small businesses that are located are flooded. An industrial park is flooded. The high school is flooded. Well over 100 homes are flooded down along the Merrimack and Big River.
Fire District spokesman Scott Bartholomew, 14 people have died in severe flooding in Missouri in the past week. A raging fire is consuming a 63-story residential building in Dubai. The blaze broke out about 2 hours before midnight when the New Year's fireworks display was set to begin. Some injuries have been reported, most of them minor. On the final trading day of 2015, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed down 178 points, the Nasdaq down 58. This is NPR News in Washington.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. The federal government requires school districts across the country to use a uniform calculation to determine graduation rates. That data was generally reported on a state-by-state basis, but that changed when Sarah Butrymovich mapped graduation rates for the 2012-2013 school year across the country by district. She's data editor at Hechinger Report, a nonprofit education news outlet.
There's definitely regional differences across the country. For instance, the Southeast tends to have a lot lower graduation rates, whereas the middle of the country, the Midwest, is doing a little bit better. And there's also a lot of states like Arizona where there's pretty significant variation within the state, and that's what's masked when the government only releases these statewide averages.
So what kinds of differences did you see in different parts of the state here?
In Arizona, I mean, just to give you an idea, your graduation rates range from 100% to 33%, so there's a lot of variation. The statewide graduation rate is 75%, so there are more, you know, sort of on the lower end of the spectrum from what I was looking at. But, you know, you can see pretty clearly across the northern part of the state, basically anything bordering Utah and Nevada has a graduation rate lower than 75%. Most of the Navajo reservation is included in that. And then once you get a little further south in the state, you start to see districts with some higher graduation rates popping up, but it's somewhat sporadic. Most of the higher performers are kind of isolated.
Yeah, which ones did do well? I mean, what part of the state, and was there anything sort of, were there any themes sort of those districts where the schools did particularly well?
There's a cluster in the very southeast corner of the state. I think it's St. David, Tombstone, and Union Valley, where you see basically more than two higher performing districts with graduation rates over 90% together. That's the only place you see that in the state. But then there's also Joseph City is one of those places with 100% graduation rate that I was talking about before.
What did you find in the Phoenix metro area?
So in the metro area, Phoenix itself had about a 74% graduation rate. And then as you sort of get in to the wider area, the graduation rates start to bump up slightly. Immediately to the west, it's only a little bit higher. And then as you get a little further west, it keeps going up. North of Phoenix had more significant differences than the west or the east did. Those districts tended to do a little better. So you see sort of this urban core ringed by districts that are doing better and having higher rates sort of bleeding out from that. I think that's a pretty common theme that I'm seeing across urban areas. You know, it's the same thing in Chicago and Boston. So with that, Phoenix sort of fits right into what you'd expect.
One of the things that struck me looking at the map was, and it was color-coded by sort of the percentage of high school graduation, and basically the entire perimeter of Arizona pretty much was on the lower end, that sort of lighter green color. And then there were some darker colors, which meant better rates sort of as you got in more toward the interior of the state. Is that something that you found in other states, or is that unique to Arizona?
That was pretty unique to Arizona. You know, a lot of other states, you could see sort of the boundaries between other states, but it wasn't necessarily so stark, and it all kind of shifted together. Or districts that just were completely across the board doing really poorly, and green was the color for under 75%. So just states where districts were, you know, all some shade of green. And again, that's one of the reasons we wanted to do this, is because you get these states where it's really hard to explain exactly what's happening in Arizona. There's some geographic pattern, and then there's a lot of sporadic differences between the districts.
Sarah Butramovich is data editor at Hechinger Report, a nonprofit education news outlet.
For a lot of us, the idea of using an outhouse for our personal business is not at the top of the list of things we want to do. Indoor plumbing was a great technological advance. But Professor Richard Melzer of the University of New Mexico, Valencia, has researched the importance of outhouses in telling some of the history of the Old West and Southwest life. Professor Melzer, you had previously studied cemeteries in New Mexico. How did you move on to outhouses?
As I was going around the state, these rural areas especially, I found these outhouses, and I was just amazed at how many were still around. We estimate there's at least 12,000 in the state today.
Were people maintaining them because they realized their importance, or in some cases, were they just forgotten about?
Very often they were forgotten about. Sometimes they still use them as backup systems and as quaint things to keep around, reminders of the past. People have great nostalgia for outhouses.
No, it's interesting because I think the stereotype is that outhouses are used for a specific purpose, and yet people in the Old West times used them for multiple reasons. What were some of those other reasons?
Well, they certainly were social centers, if you believe it or not, because some people, especially if they had two holes in the outhouse, they could go out there and get some private space for conversations.
Wow, that's...
Sometimes people would go out to the outhouse just for privacy. Getting away from the large families and small houses. Unfortunately, some people went out to the outhouses for vices, including liquor. It's amazing how many thousands of bottles people find in old outhouses, in the holes. Some people went out to outhouses for reading. They read newspapers. Very often the outhouses would have newspapers to line the walls. We've seen Bibles in outhouses, calendars, and, of course, the ever-present catalogs. They were used for reading and it was sort of like their eBay, I guess, of their day.
Wow, that's incredible.
But the main thing was that the catalogs were used as their form of toilet paper. Sears was considered the best catalog for this purpose. It had yellow index paper that was just soft and the best. Montgomery Ward's was next, and last was Spiegel. The paper was considered way too hard.
I'm guessing, harsh. I'm guessing Sears wouldn't use that in their marketing campaign these days, right?
That's right, yes. One woman wrote into Sears and asked for a new catalog, and they suggested that she buy toilet paper. They can order it from page 142. And she responded that if she still had page 142, she would need another catalog.
Were there still people who said, now, Richard, you're a historian. This is really what you want to study?
People do have fond memories of outhouses. It's so interesting to see. Not only the outhouses, but the pranks that went with them. You know, people, especially on Halloween, tossing them over.
Oh, God.
And wedging them shut so people couldn't get out. So they have good memories of the of this part of our past.
I guess that's a good memory for people who are not in the outhouse at the time, right?
Well, that's true.
I suppose if people could get past some aspect of outhouses in terms of the perception of them, are there lessons we can learn in terms of, I don't know, conservation?
Many people have that opinion today because of the use of water and resources in the facilities we use now. It's interesting. We think of outhouses as old and primitive, but in their day, they were considered modern and sanitary compared to what had been done in the past. So we're evolving, I guess, but some people still think that we could be more sanitary and make better use of resources.
Professor Richard Melzer of the University of New Mexico, Valencia.
One of America's foremost groups of Western art has a big anniversary this year. And to celebrate Western spirit, Scottsdale's Museum of the West is looking back at the 50 years of the Cowboy Artists of America in a retrospective. Joining me to talk about it are Tricia Loescher, the museum's chief curator, and Prescott-based sculptor and painter John Coleman, a member of the Cowboy Artists of America. Tricia, do people have an image in their mind of what Western art is?
Well, there are a lot of ideologies and myths and stereotypes and perceptions of the American West, that are both international and local, regional. And it really is, the West is many different things to different people. It depends on, I have found as a curator, people's backgrounds, their heritage, what culture they're from, how they define the American West. So there are multiple perceptions and perspectives of what defines the West.
John, when you are creating your art and sort of visualizing it in your mind before you start, what in your mind is Western art?
Western art to me is based on American mythology. I'm the Anglo doing Native American imagery, and I think of it purely as mythological. I believe that the Native Americans' history is so full of storylines and metaphors that, that's been my specialty now for the last 25 years.
How do you try to tell those stories through your art?
Well, the beauty of it is that because I'm a history artist, most people have a general idea, when they're thinking in terms of history, what they're looking at. My job is to sort of chime in on that part of it and then kind of incomplete it to where there's room for them to participate in the art. It's a lot like choreographing a play. You're setting up something that will invite the viewer in and give them an opportunity to start thinking in terms of their own personal experience.
Tricia, have you found that Western art has evolved over the 50 years that this organization has been in existence?
It definitely has, and it continues to evolve, and that's one of the exciting things of being the curator for the exhibition, is to have looked back at, we have a representative piece, at least one from every artist who was ever a member of the CAA, and you can really see this wonderful evolution, beginning with the earlier artists that were inducted in the 1960s, and you start to read their biographies and listen to stories about them and learn how many of them were illustrators and started off, even doing comic strips and things like that. So you can see these kinds of qualities in these trainings in the earlier artists that may not be so prevalent in the training of artists today. But the evolution just continues, and as a curator, it's a fascinating thing to see, where it's going to go in the next 50 years in the future of the cowboy artists.
John, when you're talking about doing art based on history, a lot of that history, in many ways, especially as it pertains to Native Americans, is kind of sensitive with some groups, and that the treatment of your subjects was not always the finest. How do you handle that, or do you handle that when you're putting your pieces together?
The first thing that I make it very clear is that I'm not a Native American, and I don't know what it would be like to be a Native American. The celebration in my work comes through the idea of the American experience. And when you're talking American mythology, of course, mythology in itself is better illustrated through another culture. In other words, if I was doing my own culture, I probably wouldn't call it mythology. I'd call it history. So what I'm doing is I'm trying to create an impression, and it's my impression. So when I'm telling these stories, they're really coming through a lot of the stories that the Native Americans have talked about, and of course coupled with stories that have gone through my own culture's history. But the thing that interests me as an artist is really telling stories that relate us. In other words, put us all together that are relatable.
There's a lot of talk, it seems, about sort of the demise of the cowboy culture and how ranches are closing and, growth and development are swallowing up some of these open ranges. And I'm wondering if you think that the idea of Western art and sort of the genre of Western art is in similar danger to the culture that much of it depicts.
You know, that question does come up a lot, and I really don't feel like it is. It is a culture that is very much alive, and, you know, we are in discussion about doing exhibitions, you know, internationally at some point. So there's a national and international interest in art of the American West.
John, what do you think?
Well, yeah, the culture of the cowboy and what it stands for is, I think, what most people that are inclined to relate to it. The thing that they enjoy, you know, is that natural emotional feeling that comes through it. Maybe not necessarily whether or not these cowboys are actually the culture of the cowboy and the cattle drives, but the mythology of the cowboy and what the cowboy stands for. And I think that the more we start to lose something, I think the more people start to treasure it.
It's interesting you say that, John, because I was thinking to myself as you were talking that I wonder if it's possible that as there are fewer real-life cowboys and sort of the West changes and becomes more like the rest of the country than what it has been, if there might be more of a demand for Western art because people miss what's not there. They can't really go talk to a real cowboy anymore. They have to see it in a museum or see an image of a cowboy in a piece of art.
Yeah, I think that's a natural human condition. I think that's why we call it romance. It's usually the stories we make up in our head. A lot of times they can even be more beautiful than reality. That's part of the job of the cowboy artists of America, and that's been a big part of our popularity, is people come in and vicariously they can feel a little bit of that life through our art.
John Coleman is a painter and sculptor based in Prescott and a member of the Cowboy Artists of America. We also heard from Tricia Loescher, chief curator at Western Spirit, Scottsdale's Museum of the West. The exhibit celebrating 50 years of the Cowboy Artists of America runs through the end of May.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
It's like really soft.
It's like you're rubbing your hand against, like, a blanket.
Oh, my God!
They feel, like, gooey and smooth.
Hi!
My name is Ashley Pickett. I am petting stingrays and feeding stingrays.
What about the big one right here?
The hungry?
Their mouth is on the bottom. It's weird.
And if you guys actually put your hands in the water, keep them flat and still, the stingrays can sense that pulse in your wrist.
I was feeding one, and it, like, I felt their, like, teeth, I think, touch my thumb, and it freaked me out.
When they're hungry, they splash.
That's Lexi and Xavier Sansouris, along with Ashley Pickett, feeding stingrays at the Phoenix Zoo. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just think we should go underwater, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
And you're listening to the show on KJZZ on this New Year's Eve afternoon.
KJZZ is supported by Nationwide Gourmets of Arizona, a partner of China Mist Tea, Lavazza Italian Coffees, and Roasters of Cave Creek Locally Roasted Coffees, providing coffee services for business and restaurants valley-wide and in Tucson. More information at nationwidegourmets.com.
Checking traffic in Central Phoenix on the 10 West at 7th Avenue, the left lanes are blocked by a crash. On the 202 West at 24th Street, the shoulder is blocked. Up north, watch for crashes on the 101 northbound at Thunderbird and on the 17 northbound at Greenway. At west, on the 10 West at Avondale, a crash is blocking the shoulder. And farther east, crashes on the 101 southbound at the 60 exit ramp and also on the 60 East at Val Vista. We're still looking for that expected high of 62 degrees in Phoenix today. Tonight, mostly clear skies expected, lows in the upper 30s.
Good afternoon. This is a special holiday edition of the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. Parents have been known to be willing to do just about anything for their kids. And new research shows this intimate relationship between mother and child begins even before birth, although the effects aren't always positive. That's because some fetal cells make their way into the mom's bloodstream, something known as fetal microchimerism. Amy Boddy is a researcher in the psychology department at Arizona State University. And Amy, what have you been studying?
We're looking at how fetal cells interact with the maternal body. So during pregnancy, fetal cells cross the placenta barrier and enter the maternal body. This is well known among doctors and scientists. But then after pregnancy, it had originally been thought that most of these cells in fetal DNA is cleared from the mother's body along with a baby. But research has been showing that there are cells that do stay in the maternal body after pregnancy, and they can be found decades later. And a big important question is, what are they doing there? And it seems like literature is painting a really paradoxical picture, where it seems in some instances it's helping, benefiting the mother, and in other instances, it's actually causing harm.
So in what areas can having the fetal cells in the mother's body after delivery help, and in what ways does it hurt the mother?
So these type of cells that are probably the most interesting that cross the placenta are stem-like cells. So these are cells that have the ability to specialize into different cells in the maternal body. And so the ways that they can help the mother is there's been a lot of documented research where they've, in mouse models, have shown that the fetal cells actually migrate to a site of injury and seem to be helping heal the mother. And in human studies, they've been shown in C-section scars. So they've migrated to the C-section wound and are thought to have expressed certain proteins that make scientists believe that they are helping the mother.
And in what ways are they not so good?
So there's been a lot of research in women during labor and after labor in autoimmune diseases and cancer. And it seems like from tissue biopsies, there's sometimes more fetal cells in the diseased tissue than in the healthy tissue, leading us to believe that they may be either causing this autoimmune disease or cancer.
Do you have a sense of how far throughout the mother's body these fetal cells are traveling? Or do they tend to stay close to where they started, like near the womb, or are they all over the place?
Well, good question. They typically are traveling through the blood, right? And so the blood ends up in the lung first. So the highest concentration typically is in the lung, and then they travel through the other organs. There is now one study that came out in 2013 showing that there was expression of male DNA in a mother's brain, suggesting that it was from her son that she was pregnant with. So they can reach as far as the brain.
You would think evolutionarily that some of the negative effects from childbirth maybe would have been done away with years ago. Otherwise, maybe we would stop having kids, right? If having them is more dangerous than childbirth already is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think a major point that a lot of times when people hear about fetal cell microchimerism, they only hear about the conflict. But what we want to bring to light is that placenta mammals have been evolving with this fetal microchimerism for millions of years. So there's likely some cooperative benefit as well.
So what's the next phase of this kind of research that you're looking to do?
We're really interested in what fetal cells are doing in a normal pregnancy and postpartum, what they could likely be doing to help cooperate with the mother. If they're involved in lactational biology, would be very interesting. And also looking at just if fetal cells have any involvement in the hormonal system in the mother and if they play a role in maternal bonding. So those are our future directions.
Amy Boddy is a researcher in the psychology department at ASU. She studies, among many other things, maternal-fetal conflict. Amy, thank you.
Thank you.
When it was introduced to the Valley decades ago, it became an international phenomenon. It was unique, inside and out. The place still exists, but is somewhat forgotten. The show's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez has more.
A strategically sunken home in the middle of an Ahwatukee neighborhood once caught the attention of the world. It was called the House of the Future. Did you know the House of the Future was a one-of-a-kind home built with a cutting-edge multi-computer network.
It was covered in periodicals, the media of the time, in 33 different countries. It became a world-famous house, in essence.
Martin Gibson has researched the story behind the House of the Future that opened in February 1980.
It was on TV shows of the time back then. That's Incredible, PM Magazine. They came out to little old Ahwatukee, Arizona, and profiled this futuristic house. And over 4 years, 250,000 people came to take the tour. And in the process, Presley sold a lot of regular houses.
Randall Presley was a real estate investor who founded Ahwatukee and the reason why the House of the Future was built. Gibson and I decided to meet at the home in the neighborhood known today as Custom Estates.
It is on Equestrian Trail, so those two little lights are flower pots there. That is the entranceway.
The house is privately owned, and we hoped the owner would allow us a look inside. Gibson says more than 30 years ago, Presley was developing this area on the southern end of South Mountain. He wanted something interesting to lure potential buyers, so he approached the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation and asked if they would develop a home like no other.
It had to have three things. It had to be futuristic. It had to accommodate a large number of people. It had to be a showplace that people could walk through, unlike a regular house. I hear the bell. It works. Okay. I don't think we're going to get
any. Dozens of companies helped build the property at an estimated cost of more than $2 million, a portion of it in donated materials. When completed, this was a 3,100-square-foot house installed with a state-of-the-art computer system with numerous sensors. It monitored the sliding doors and windows, controlled the temperature and humidity. It detected night and day and controlled the lights accordingly. And these were just a few of its many futuristic features.
It was a leap of faith. It was someone who, like Presley, had a vision and perhaps saw this being kind of the centerpiece of all the development that followed in the next 35 years.
After 4 years, the house was sold and has been sold several times over the years. Today, the property is more like a house of the past. The mostly subterranean home was constructed with a prism-shaped roof covered in bright copper. Decades later, the roof is patina green. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
If you know of things that make Phoenix unique or just know things that we should know, please tell us about them. You can email us at theshow@kjzz.org. Well, with a little help from our partners at The World, that's the show for New Year's Eve.
You can listen to other podcasts of the show on the KJZZ mobile app.
You can also find more Did You Know segments and sounds of the city at theshow.kjzz.org.
I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody.
And we're wishing you a happy and healthy 2016.
Happy New Year.